It is depressing what many people, and sometimes whole occult societies, make out of their ostensible observations. They only blur our view of reality and deter serious scholars from dealing with verified phenomena because they are afraid of exposing themselves to ridicule. On 6 November, 1967, during a transmission by German Television 2 on the subject Invasion from the Cosmos, the captain of a Lufthansa aircraft told of an incident of which he and four members of the crew were eyewitnesses. On 15 February, 1967, about 10 to 15 minutes before landing in San Francisco, they saw close to their own machine a flying object with a diameter of about 33 feet that shone dazzlingly and flew alongside them for some time. They sent their observations to the University of Colorado, which, for want of a better explanation, surmised that the flying object was part of a previously launched rocket falling to the ground. The pilot explained that with over a million miles of flying experience, he was as unable as his colleagues to believe that a falling piece of metal could stay in the air for a quarter of an hour, have such dimensions and fly alongside an aircraft. He believed this explanation even less, since this unidentified flying object had been observable from the ground for nearly three quarters of an hour. The German pilot certainly did not give the impression of being a visionary. Two reports from Die Süddeutsche Zeitung, Munich, for 21st and 23rd of November, 1967, Belgrade, from our own correspondent, unidentified flying objects, UFOs, have been sighted over various districts of Southeast Europe during the last few days. At the weekend, an amateur astronomer photographed three of these gleaming celestial objects at a gram. But while the experts were still giving their opinions of this photograph that was splashed across several columns of the Yugoslavian papers, more UFOs have already been reported from the mountainous region of Montenegro, where they were even supposed to have caused several forest fires. These accounts come mainly from the village of Ivangrad, where the inhabitants swear black and blue that they have observed strange brightly illuminated heavenly bodies every evening during the last few days. The authorities confirm that several forest fires have occurred in this district, but so far cannot explain what started them. Sofia, UPI, a UFO has appeared over the Bulgarian capital of Sofia. According to the report of the Bulgarian news agency BTA, the UFO could be recognized with the naked eye. BTA says that the flying body was bigger than the sun's disk and later took the shape of a trapeze. The flying body is supposed to have emitted powerful rays. It was also observed by telescope in Sofia. A scientific collaborator of the Bulgarian Institute for Hydrology and Meteorology said that the flying body apparently moved under its own power. It was flying about 18 miles above the Earth. People block the road to serious research by boundless stupidity. There are contact men who claim to be in communication with extraterrestrial beings. There are groups who develop fanciful religious ideas from hitherto unexplained phenomena, or build cranky philosophies of life from them, or even claim to have received orders for the salvation of mankind from UFO crews. Among the religious fanatics, the Egyptian UFO angel naturally comes from Muhammad, the Asiatic one from Buddha, and the Christian one directly from Jesus. At the 7th International World Congress of UFO Investigators, in the autumn of 1967, Professor Hermann Oberth, the man known as the father of space travel and the teacher of Wernher von Braun, said that UFOs were still an extra scientific problem, but, said Oberth, UFOs were probably spaceships from unknown worlds, and to use his own words, obviously the beings who man and fly them are far ahead of us culturally, and if we go about things properly we can learn a lot from them. Oberth, who accurately predicted rocket development on Earth, suspects that the prerequisites for abiogenesis exist on other planets in the solar system. Oberth, a research scientist himself, demands that serious scientists, too, should tackle problems that may seem fantastic at first. Scholars behave like stuffed geese who refuse to digest anything else. They simply reject new ideas as nonsense. On the 17th of November 1967, under the headline Second Thoughts, Dizit said, "For years the Russians have ridiculed Western hysteria about flying saucers. Not long ago Pravda contained an official denial that such peculiar celestial vehicles existed. Now the Air Force General Anatoly Stolyakov has been appointed director of a committee which is to examine all reports of UFOs. In this connection the London Times writes, whether UFOs are the product of collective hallucinations, whether they originate from Venusian visitors or are to be understood as a divine revelation, there must be an explanation for them, otherwise the Russians would never have set up a committee of inquiry. The most spectacular and puzzling incident connected with the phenomenon of matter from the universe took place at 7:17 on the morning of 30th of June, 1908, in the Siberian taiga. A fireball shot across the sky and was lost in the steppe. Travelers on the Trans-Siberian Railway observed a glowing mass which moved from south to north. A thunderbolt shook the train, explosions followed and most of the seismographic stations in the world registered an appreciable earth tremor. At Irkutsk, 550 miles from the epicenter, the needle of the seismograph went on quivering for nearly an hour. The noise could be heard over a radius of 621 miles. Whole herds of reindeer were destroyed. Nomads were whirled up into the air with their tents. Not until 1921 did Professor Kulik begin to collect eyewitness accounts. Finally, he also succeeded in collecting the money for a scientific expedition to this sparsely populated region of the taiga. When the expedition reached the stony Tunguska in 1927, they were convinced that they would find the crater made by a gigantic meteorite. Their conviction turned out to be quite wrong. They saw the first trees without tops as much as 37 miles from the center of the explosion. The nearer they came to the critical point, the more barren the district became. Trees stood there like shaved telegraph poles. In the vicinity of the center even the strongest trees had been snapped off outwards. Last they found traces of a tremendous conflagration. Pushing on further north, the expedition became convinced that a vast explosion must have taken place. When they came across holes of all sizes in swampy ground they suspected the impact of meteorites, they dug and drilled in the marshy ground without finding a single remnant, a piece of iron, a bit of nickel or a lump of stone. 2 years later the search was continued with bigger drills and improved technical resources. They drilled to a depth of 118 feet without finding a single trace of any kind of meteoric material. In 1961 and 1963 two more expeditions were sent to the Tunguska by the Soviet Academy of Sciences. The 1963 expedition was under the leadership of the geophysician Solotov. This group of scientists, now equipped with the most modern technical appliances, came to the conclusion that the explosion in the Siberian Tunguska must have been a nuclear one. The type of an explosion can be determined when several physical orders of magnitude that caused it are known. One of these orders of magnitude in the Tunguska explosion was known in the vast amount of radiant energy emitted. In the taiga the expedition found trees 11 miles from the center of the explosion that had been exposed to radiation and set on fire by it at the moment of explosion. But a growing tree can only catch fire if the amount of radiant energy per square centimeters reaches 70 to 100 calories. Yet the flash of the explosion was so bright that it continued to cast secondary shadows at a distance of 124 miles from the epicenter. From these measurements they worked out that the radiant energy of the explosion must have been around 28 by 10 less than 23 greater than ergs. Let me explain, the erg in science is the so-called measurement of work. A beetle with a mass of 1 gram performs 981 ergs worth of work when it climbs a wall 1 centimeter high. The expedition found branches and twigs on the tops of trees that had been carbonized, up to range of 11 miles. From this they concluded that sudden heating had taken place. This was the result of an explosion, not a forest fire. These carbonizations were only found where there had been no shadows to interrupt the diffusion of the flash. Clearly and unquestionably it must have been a case of radiation. The sum of all these effects makes the energy of 10 less than 23 greater than ergs necessary for the gigantic devastation. This immense energy corresponds to the destructive power of an atom bomb weighing 10 megatons or 1 eggs. All the investigations confirmed a nuclear explosion and related to the realm of fable explanations such as the impact of a comet or the fall of a great meteorite. What explanations are offered for this nuclear explosion in the year 1908? In March 1964, an article in the reputable Leningrad paper Zvezda put forward the theory that intelligent beings living on a planet in the constellation Cygnus had tried to make contact with the Earth. The authors, Jen Richaltoff and Valentina Shurileva, said that the impact in the Siberian taiga was a response to the colossal explosion-like eruption of the volcano Krakatoa in the Indian Ocean that had sent a large concentration of radio waves into the universe when it erupted in 1853. The distant stellar beings had erroneously taken the radio waves for a signal from space, so they had directed a laser beam, which was much too strong, at the Earth. And when the beam hit the Earth's atmosphere high above Siberia, it had turned into matter. I must admit that I do not accept this explanation because it seems too far-fetched. I am equally unable to accept the theory that seeks to explain the incident by the impact of antimatter. Even though I believe that there is antimatter in the depths of the cosmos, there cannot be any left in the Tunguska, because the collision of matter and antimatter results in their mutual dissolution. Moreover, the possibility of a piece of antimatter reaching the Earth without a collision with matter on its long journey is very remote. I prefer to adhere to the opinion of those who suspect that the nuclear explosion was caused by an unknown spaceship's energy pile bursting. Fantastic. Of course, but does that make it impossible? There are shelves and shelves of literature about the Tunguska meteorite. There is one further fact I want to emphasize: radioactivity around the center of the explosion in the taiga is twice as high, even today, as elsewhere. Careful investigation of trees and their annual rings confirm an appreciable increase in radioactivity since 1908. Until a single, exact, indubitable scientific proof of the phenomenon, and many others, is produced, no one has the right to discard an explanation within the bounds of credibility without giving his reasons. Our knowledge of the planets in our solar system is pretty comprehensive. Mars is the only planet where life in our sense of the word might exist, and then only in limited quantities. Man has set the theoretical boundary to the possibility of life in his sense. This boundary is called the ecosphere. In our solar system only Venus, the Earth and Mars lie within the limits of the ecosphere. Nevertheless, we should remember that the determination of the ecosphere is based on our conception of life, and that unknown life is by no means necessarily bound to our premises for life. Until 1962 Venus was considered as a possible home for life. That is until Mariner 2 got within about 21,000 miles of Venus. According to the information it transmitted, Venus can now be ruled out as a supporter of life. It emerged from Mariner 2's reports that the average surface temperature on both light and dark sides was 420 C. Such a temperature means that there could be no water, but only lakes of molten metal on the surface. The popular idea of Venus as the twin sister of the Earth is over and done with, even though the carbureted hydrogen present could be a culture medium for all kinds of bacteria. It is not long since scientists claimed that life on Mars is inconceivable. For some time now that has become is scarcely conceivable. For after the successful reconnaissance mission by Mariner 4 we must concede, even if reluctantly, that the possibility of life on Mars is not unlikely. It is also within the bounds of possibility that unable Mars had its own civilization untold millennia ago. In any case, the Martian moon Phobos deserves special attention. Mars has two moons, Phobos and Deimos, in Greek, fear and terror. They were known long before the American astronomer Asaph Hall discovered them in 1877. As early as 1610, Johannes Kepler suspected that Mars was accompanied by two satellites. Although the Capucine monk Schkyle may have claimed to have seen the Martian moons a few years earlier, he must have been mistaken, for the tiny Martian moons could not possibly be seen with the optical instruments of his day. A fascinating description of them is given by Jonathan Swift in A Voyage to Laputa and Japan, which forms part 3 of Gulliver's Travels. Not only does he describe the two Martian moons, but he also gives their size and orbits. This quotation comes from Chapter 3, The Laputan astronomers spend the greatest part of their lives in observing the celestial bodies, which they do by the assistance of glasses far excelling ours in goodness. For although their largest telescopes do not exceed 3 feet, they magnify much more than those of 100 yards among us and at the same time show the stars with greater clearness. This advantage hath enabled them to extend their discoveries much further than our astronomers in Europe, for they have made a catalogue of 10,000 fixed stars, whereas the largest of ours do not contain above 1/3 part of that number. They have likewise discovered 2 lesser stars, or satellites, which revolve about Mars, whereof the innermost is distant from the center of the primary planet exactly 3 of the diameters, and the outermost 5. The former revolves in the space of 10 hours, and the latter in 21.5, so that the squares of their periodical times are very near in the same proportion with the cubes of their distance from the center of Mars, which evidently shows them to be governed by the same law of gravitation that influences the other heavenly bodies. How could Swift describe the Martian satellites when they were not discovered until 150 years later? Undoubtedly the Martian satellites were suspected by some astronomers before Swift, but suspicions are not nearly enough for such precise data. We do not know where Swift got his knowledge from. Actually, these satellites are the smallest and strangest moons in our solar system. They rotate in almost circular orbits above the equator. If they reflect the same amount of light as our moon, then Phobos must have a diameter of 10 miles and Deimos one of only 5 miles. But if they are artificial moons and so reflect still more light, they would actually be even smaller. They are the only known moons in our solar system to move around their mother planet faster than she herself rotates. In relation to the rotation of Mars, Phobos completes 2 orbits in 1 Martian day, whereas Deimos moves only a little faster around Mars than the planet itself rotates. In 1862, when the Earth was in a very favorable position in relation to Mars, people sought in vain for the Martian satellites. They were not discovered until 15 years later. The theory of planetoids came up because several astronomers suspected that the Martian moons were fragments from space which Mars had attracted. But the theory of planetoids is untenable, for both the Martian moons revolve in almost the same planes above the equator. One fragment from space might do that by chance, but not two. Finally, measurable facts produced modern satellite theory. The renowned American astronomer Carl Sagan and the Russian scientist Shlovsky, in their book Intelligent Life in the Universe, published in 1966, accept that the moon Phobos is an artificial satellite. As the result of a series of measurements, Sagan came to the conclusion that Phobos must be hollow and a hollow moon cannot be natural. In fact, the peculiarities of Phobos's orbit bear no relation to its apparent mass, whereas such orbits are typical in the case of hollow bodies. The Russian Shlovsky, director of the Department of Radio Astronomy in the Moscow Sternberg Institute, made the same statement after he had observed that a peculiar unnatural acceleration could be confirmed in the movement of the Martian moon Phobos. This acceleration is identical with the phenomenon which has been established in the case of our own artificial satellites. Today people take these fantastic theories of Sagan and Shlovsky very seriously. The Americans plan further Martian probes, which are also intended to take the bearings of the Martian moons. In the years ahead, the Russians intend to observe the movements of the Martian moons from several observatories. If the view supported by reputable scientists in East and West that Mars once had an advanced civilization is correct, the question arises, why does it no longer exist today? Did the intelligences on Mars have to seek a new environment? Did their home planet, which was losing more and more oxygen, force them to look for new territories to settle? Was a cosmic catastrophe responsible for the downfall of the civilization? Lastly, were some of the inhabitants of Mars able to escape to a neighboring planet? In his book Worlds in Collision, published in 1950, and still much discussed in scientific circles, Dr. Emanuel Velikovsky declared that a giant comet had crashed into Mars and that Venus had been formed as a result of this collision. His theory can be proved if Venus has a high surface temperature, clouds containing carbureted hydrogen and an anomalous rotation. Evaluation of the data provided by Mariner 2 confirms Velikovsky's theory. Venus is the only planet which rotates backwards, that is the only planet that does not follow the rules of our solar system as do Mercury, the Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus and Neptune. But if a cosmically caused catastrophe is a possible reason for the destruction of a civilization on the planet Mars, that would also provide material for my theory that the Earth may have received visits from space in the very remote past. The thesis that a group of Martian giants perhaps escaped to Earth to found the new culture of Homo sapiens by breeding with the semi-intelligent beings living there then becomes a speculative possibility. Since the gravity of Mars is not as strong as that of the Earth, it can be assumed that the build of Martian men was heavier and bigger than that of the Earth men. If there were anything in this argument, we should have the giants who come from the stars, who could move enormous blocks of stone, who instructed men in arts still unknown on Earth and who finally died out. Never did we know so little about so much as today. I am certain that the theme men and unknown intelligences will remain on the agenda of research until every puzzle that can be solved has found an answer. Chapter 11. The Search for Direct Communication at 4 a.m. on 1st of April, 1960, an experiment began in a lonely valley in West Virginia. The big 85-foot radio telescope at Green Bank was trained on the Startosity, 11.8 light-years away. The young American astronomer, Dr. Frank Drake, who enjoys considerable fame as a scientist and acted as leader of this project, wanted to tune into the radio transmissions of other civilizations in order to pick up signals from unknown intelligences in outer space. The first series of experiments lasted 150 hours. They passed into history as Project OSMA, although it was a failure. The experiment was broken off, not because some of the participating scientists expressed the view that there were no radio transmission in space, but rather because it was realized that at the time there was no apparatus sensitive enough to reach the desired goal. OSMA will not be the only experiment of its kind. Possibly a radio telescope will be erected on the Moon that will be able to scan the immeasurable spaces between the stars for radio signals, free from terrestrial interference. However, it must be asked whether the search for radio signals really helps our space research and whether it might not be more practical for us to do the sending of radio signals into space. Of course, we cannot expect unknown intelligences to understand Russian or Spanish or English and to be sitting there waiting to be contacted. There remain three possibilities by which we can make ourselves known: mathematical symbols, laser beams and pictures. The first of these seems most likely to succeed. In order to sense such symbols, we shall have to discover and fix intergalactic wavelengths that stand a good chance of being received throughout the cosmos. 1420 MHz would provide such a frequency, for that is the radiation frequency of the neutral hydrogen that results from the collision of hydrogen atoms. Since hydrogen is an element, this radiation frequency could be known throughout the universe. Besides, 1420 MHz lies outside the overcrowded scale of terrestrial wavelengths. The possibility of errors and interference factors would be reduced to a minimum. In this way, radio impulses could be sent into space, and if unknown intelligences exist, they would recognize them. In this connection, a news item from Die Zeit for the 22nd of December 1967 is most interesting. Under the headline "The Moon Will Be Bombarded by Flashes," we read, "The distance of the Moon from the Earth is known to the nearest few hundred yards, but astronomers refuse to be satisfied with that. So astronauts on one of the first flights to the Earth's satellite will take mirrors with them and set them up there. These mirrors, like the corner of a room, will consist of three reflecting planes standing at right angles to each other and will have the property of returning any light that strikes them back to the source of the light. This mirror system will be bombarded from the Earth by a laser emitting flashes of light, each lasting for a hundred millionth of a second. The laser will be used in conjunction with a telescope with an aperture of 150 meters. The light reflected from the Moon will be picked up by this telescope and led to a photocopier. The distance of the Moon can then be determined to 1.5 meters from the known speed of light and the time taken by a laser beam for the journey there and back. The same kind of thing is also conceivable in reverse. Radio waves have been traversing the universe for a very long time. If my hypothesis is correct, isn't it credible that unknown intelligences are also announcing themselves to us? For example, the radiation energy of CTA-102 suddenly increased in the autumn of 1964. Russian astronomers informed the world that they had possibly received signals from an extraterrestrial supercivilization. This radio star CTA-102 was listed under catalog number 102 by radio astronomers of the California Institute of Technology, hence its name. The astronomer Shola Mutsky said in the lecture room of the Sternberg Institute in Moscow on 13 April, 1965, "At the end of September and the beginning of October 1964, the radiation energy from CTA-102 was much stronger, but only for a short time, then it diminished again. We registered this and waited. Towards the end of the year, the intensity of the source suddenly increased again. It reached a second peak exactly 100 days after the first record was taken." His chief, Professor Shlofsky, added that such fluctuations in radiation were very unusual. Meanwhile, the Dutch astrophysicist Maarten Schmidt has found out by exact measurements that CTA-102 must be about 10 million light-years from the Earth. That means that if the radio beams originated from intelligent beings, they must have been radiated 10 million years ago. But according to the calculations of present-day research, our planet simply did not exist at that time. This realization could mean a kind of coup de grace to the search for other living beings in the universe. But if the search for life in the universe had no chance of success, astrophysicists in America and Russia, at Jodrell Bank and at Stockert near Bonn in Germany, would not be concentrating their research on what are known as radio stars and quasars with enormous directional antennae. The fixed stars Epsilon Eridani and Tau Ceti are respectively 10.2 and 11.8 light-years away from us. So radio waves aimed at these neighbors would be about 11 light-years underway, and an answer from them could reasonably reach us in 22 years. Radio communications with more distant stars would take correspondingly longer. Civilizations situated at distances reckoned in millions of light-years are quite unsuitable for making contact with by means of radio waves. But our radio waves are only technical means of making such attempts. For example, we could also make ourselves optically noticeable. A powerful laser beam directed at Mars or Jupiter could not remain unnoticed, provided that intelligent living beings are in existence there. Laser is the abbreviation for light amplification by the stimulated emission of radiation. Another, somewhat fantastic sounding possibility would be to cultivate vast areas of soil so that tremendous color contrasts appeared, which at the same time represented a geometrical or mathematical symbol of universal validity. One audacious but perfectly realizable idea: a gigantic equilateral triangle would have its 600-mile-long sides sown with potatoes. In this enormous triangle, a circle would be sown with wheat. In this way, a vast yellow circle, surrounded by a green equilateral triangle, would appear every summer. Incidentally, a most useful and productive experiment. But if there are unknown intelligences that seek us as we seek them, the coloring of circle and triangle would be a hint to them that these shapes were no freaks of nature. As I have said, that is one possibility. Someone or other has also advocated erecting a chain of lighthouses which radiate their lights vertically.